Chapter 2. Most established cleaners owned their own trucks, which made sense when you considered that we basically moved houses for a living. But owning a vehicle of any sort was stupid expensive in the DFC. So I'd opted for the much cheaper route of leasing from one of the car subscription services. Better still, in a rare stroke of foresight, I'd prepaid for the entire year back in January when I'd had money to burn. I'd also bought a fancy intelligent rice maker and an augmented reality TV, both of which I'd had to turn around and sell months ago to make my rent. But the car thing at least I'd gotten right. Subscription vehicles weren't fancy, fast, or particularly safe. The small pickup I'd been given this time was missing its bumper and looked like it was made entirely from recycled plastic, but it cost less than half of what owning my own vehicle would have, and I got to use it for up to 200 hours a month. Sometimes more, if no one else had booked it. I didn't even have to drive. Once Sybil activated it, the truck's AI piloted itself. The cab didn't even have a steering console. Just a flat, plastic dash with a cheap touchscreen featuring a badly animated dog asking where I wanted to go in a cheerful, childish voice. "Institute for Magical Arts," I said as I shut the chintzy door.
"Right away, Miss Youngie,"
the truck replied.
"Would you like to upgrade your ride today? We have over 500 entertainment options from the hottest new..."
"No," I said, cutting off the upsell. "Also, no, no, no. I decline the insurance option. And no."
"Yes, ma'am,"
the vehicle said when its cheap AI finally finished processing all of my answers.
"We should reach your destination in 39 minutes. Until then, please enjoy these messages from our corporate partners."
I scrambled for the volume, frantically mashing my finger against the down arrow on the touchscreen as ads started blasting at deafening levels from the tinny speakers.
"You know, you really should just pay the extra $10 a month for the ad-free service," Sybil said when I'd gotten the cheerful jingles down to a not-hearing-destroying level. "It would improve your mental state."
"If I could afford an extra $10 a month, my mental state wouldn't need improving," I reminded her, flopping into the cheap plastic seat as the truck backed itself out of the alley. But why did it say it's going to be 40 minutes? It shouldn't take more than 20 to get to the IMA campus from here.
"Lot of activity in our way,"
Sybil said, bringing up a map of the city, which was covered in bright red warning icons.
"Looks like the DFC's doing some moving of her own."
That turned out to be a very accurate description. Everything looked relatively normal in the underground. Just the usual cheap apartment blocks, discount stores, and neon-lit vending machine bars selling the standard assortment of canned liquor. But when we turned up the ramp to the skyways, it was like entering a whole other world. The first thing that hit me was the sunlight. I cringed like a bad movie vampire when we came out of the tunnel into the upper city. Even through the smog, the summer afternoon was so blue and bright it scarcely looked real. I was so used to being under bridges that I'd almost forgotten how big the summer clouds could be. But even they were dwarfed by the city's superscrapers. I grew up moving between Seoul, LA, and Hong Kong, so I was used to giant buildings. But the ones in the DFC were on an entirely different level. Some of the glass and steel spires were a full quarter mile around at the base, with peaks so tall they created their own rain shadows. Even modern steel-strengthening spellwork couldn't account for how enormous they were, because these buildings hadn't been built by human hands. They were the product of the spirit of the city, sprouted from the ground like trees by the DFZ herself. And apparently she wasn't done. "Wow," I breathed, pressing my face against the scratched-up window. Ahead of us to the left, on the route we normally would have taken, an entire section of the new I-75 flyover had lifted from its support beams and was slowly moving to the north, much to the fury of the cars stuck on top of it. The angry blaring of horns was even louder than the advertisements still yakking through my speakers, but they were still nothing compared to the stomach-churning scrape of steel on stone from the new building that was rising from the ground where the highway had been. Even after 3.5 years in the DFZ, the sight was a shock. I gawked like a tourist, watching wide-eyed as ribbons of steel rebar shot up from the exposed underground like seedlings racing toward the sunlight. Cement followed more slowly, creeping up the metal as the new building constructed itself in front of my eyes. Given that the top of it was already visible above the skyways, there had to be multiple floors already constructed in the underground below that I wasn't seeing, not to mention foundations. I hadn't noticed a thing when I'd driven through that area this morning, though, which meant the DFZ had done all of that during the time I'd been stuck in the dead guy's apartment. God or no, that struck me as quite impressive, and I whistled in appreciation. I wonder what kind of building it'll be.
Given the area of the base, it's either another super scraper or a stadium, Sybil replied. Not that we need either. This area's too crowded as it is.
I chuckled. I think the city knows what she's doing.
Well, I just wish she'd wait until after rush hour to do it,
my AI grumped, bringing up the map again, which was updated in real time by the DFZ City Council, the only municipal service the city provided for free.
Look at this mess!
It was pretty dire. According to the warnings, I-75 had been on the move for the last 45 minutes. All the side streets near the new building had been cut off as well, on both the skyways and underground levels, and the resulting chaos had turned this entire section of the city into a parking lot. Good thing we're going south, I said, looking sympathetically at the cars stranded on top of the moving bridge. That thing doesn't look like it's coming down anytime soon.
There's no estimated end time listed on the traffic report,
Sybil confirmed, her voice disgusted.
What is the DFZ thinking? She's not exactly known for taking her citizens' convenience into account, but moving a major commuter highway on a Monday just feels like bad planning.
I shrugged. Spirits move in mysterious ways. I mean, for all we know, the delays are the point. She is the living incarnation of the city, and what's more city-like than a traffic jam? I smiled at the interstate, which was now a good 50 feet above the already elevated skyways and still rising. I'm just glad the truck's AI was smart enough to root us around.
Hooray for minimal competency, Sybil said dryly. On the bright side, though, this means there should be a lot of cleaning jobs coming up in the next few months. Historical data shows there's always a surge in vacancies after the DFZ does something big like this.
It's never comfortable to be reminded that you're an ant in a god's world, I agreed, staring up at the two enormous super scrapers that were tilting sideways to make way for the new building, sending entire floors full of office furniture sliding in the process. I just hope I'm still around to take advantage of it. Normally, this was where Sybil would insist things weren't that bad. But her protocol against lying was stronger than her directive to cheer me up. And we both knew the truth. It was right there on the wallet icon at the top of my heads-up AR display. After a year of doing really well as a cleaner, I'd hit a dry streak nothing seemed able to break. Today's fiasco was just the latest in a long line of absolutely horrid luck. If I hadn't been a mage and able to check these things for myself, I'd have sworn that I was cursed. Every time I looked, though, there was nothing. It was just plain old bad luck, statistical clustering, which meant it had to break soon. No one could be this unlucky forever. Whether I could hold out long enough to reach the other side, though, was another issue entirely. Maybe we'll get lucky and these'll turn out to be a brilliant translation of some lost alchemical text, I said, pulling the dead mage's mysterious notes out of my bag. Heidi's a sucker for that stuff, and her department has serious corporate funding. We could still make bank.
If that mage was capable of anything worth bank, he wouldn't have been living on frozen burritos in a basement apartment,
my AI pointed out. I rolled my eyes. Thanks for the vote of confidence.
I just don't want you getting your hopes too high, Sybil said. As a social support AI, it's my job to assist in your mental health, and these fits of wild optimism that crumble into crushing despair when they run into reality are not good for you. I think it would be much healthier for you to drop the notes in Heidi's box and go home for a shower before the evening auction. I don't have a nose, but I'm pretty sure you smell like dead guy.
That was undoubtedly true. But the thought of abandoning the notes, my only score from today's disgusting, back-breaking work, in a cubby at the history department's unorganized office, was too much to bear. Not a chance, I said firmly. We're going inside. If these notes are worth something, I want to know today.
Suit yourself, Sybil said. I'm just saying there's a strong likelihood this whole thing is a waste of time.
Better to waste time than money, I said stubbornly. Time I've got. Until Friday, at least.
We spent the rest of the ride in silence. Thankfully, the traffic disruption from the moving highway was mostly confined to the northern half of downtown. Midtown, where the IMA campus was moving just fine.
Once we got out of the glut, we made good time, cruising down the cheap toll lanes until we reached the turnoff for the Institute, just as the ride meter ticked to 39 minutes, exactly as predicted.
"Haven't been here in a while," I said, self-consciously brushing the grime off my warded poncho as I stepped onto the pristine white cement of IMA's new visitor pavilion.
"I like the new duck pond."
"I think it's supposed to be a reflecting pool," Sybil said. "The ducks are just swimming in it."
"Then I hope they're ready to sell their souls to pay tuition," I joked, looking around at the perfect green lawn and artistically scattered white buildings that made up IMA's main campus. "You go into debt just for breathing around here."
Like everything else that was worth real money, IMA was up on the skyways. It had a nice location, too, taking up several elevated blocks just a half mile south of the Dragon Consulate, where the Peacemaker, the dragon who claimed the DFZ as his territory, kept his lair. I wasn't sure why the DFZ allowed any dragon, particularly one as famously eccentric as the Peacemaker, to claim her as his land, but there must have been some kind of history there.
Because she loved him.
Her buildings were forever shifting around the multi-level Dragon Consulate to make sure the dragons had a clear flight path coming in. And they were always coming in. Thanks to the Peacemaker's edict, which declared that no dragon could attack another within the city without facing the Peacemaker's wrath, the DFZ had turned into a sort of dragon Switzerland. Clans that would kill each other on sight anywhere else in the world routinely met in the DFZ to talk. Not about peace. Normal dragons never talked about peace. But they talked a lot of business, which was probably why the DFZ gave them so much leeway. No one loved capitalism more than she did. And when you considered how much wealth the average dragon accumulated over their immortal life, courting them was just good sense. It was also good for IMA. Being so close to the Dragon Consulate, and the spectacle of the giant dragons that constantly flew through the sky surrounding it, gave the school an edge that other magical arts universities simply could not top. Add in the fact that they'd converted their entire Skyway campus into a lavish park, complete with water features, semi-tropical gardens, and buildings that looked like modern art installations, and the whole place just reeked of exclusivity and money. Of the three major magical colleges in the DFZ, the Institute for Magical Arts was the most expensive by an order of magnitude. While MIT Thaumaturgical and the new Wayne College of Magic had to pour their efforts into industrial spellwork research to court corporate funding, IMA dedicated itself to the art part of magical arts, with graduate programs in expressive casting, illusionary sculpture, magical theater, and my specialty, magical art history. It was the best magic-focused liberal arts school in the world, which meant it was trust fund kids all the way down. I'd fit right in when I'd first arrived almost 4 years ago. Now I felt like a homeless bum who'd wandered onto campus by accident. At least I could still look like I knew where I was going. The campus had changed a lot since I'd finished my master's degree a year and a half ago, but the path to the art history department was still drilled into my memory. Once I figured out how to get out of the fancy new visitors area, I walked straight there, ordering my truck to circle the block a few times so I wouldn't have to pay for parking,
while I cut across the bright green grass lawn toward the perfect white cube that was IMA's historical arts building. As a lowly doctoral student, Heidi's office was in the basement. It was a very nice basement, with reactive lighting and fake LED windows displaying real-time footage of famous landscapes. But it was still a bunch of closet-sized offices crammed into an underground hallway. I didn't remember which one was Heidi's anymore. It had been more than a year. But I didn't need to. Her door was still covered in the same history jokes and pictures of her and her golden retriever as I remembered. It opened the moment I knocked, revealing a startlingly tall blonde woman with tanned skin, a healthy athletic glow, and cheekbones that could cut glass.
"Opal!"
Heidi cried, rushing forward to hug me before I could warn her about my wards.
"Ugh!"
she said a moment later, snatching her arms back.
"What are you wearing? It feels like a trash bag."
"Anti-dirt wards," I explained, pointing at my poncho. "And anti a lot of other stuff, which is why it feels so slippery. That and the fact that it is actually made of plastic." Heidi looked horrified.
"Why are you wearing that horrible thing?" she asked,
stepping back to let me inside.
"You're not still working as a cleaner, are you?"
I shrugged and took a seat on the minimalist metal stool in front of her neatly organized desk.
"It's not so bad."
"Really?" she asked, shutting the door behind me.
"Because you look terrible."
I rolled my eyes.
"Thanks." "I'm serious,"
Heidi snapped, walking back to her desk.
"You're thin, and I don't mean that as a compliment."
"It's been a rough few months," I admitted, reaching into my bag. "But I'm working on turning it around. That's why I'm here, actually. I need a favor. I found these on a job, and..."
"Stop," Heidi said angrily. "Just stop right there. What do you think you're doing?"
I blinked at her. "Asking for help?"
"Help,"
she said, her perfect face growing furious.
"Opal, you vanished. You got your degree, and then you disappeared."
"I didn't disappear," I said defensively. "I was still here in the DFZ.
I just needed a change of—" "You moved out of our apartment in the middle of the night,"
she yelled at me.
"The only reason I knew you were working as a cleaner is because your mother called to see if I could talk you out of it. Which I couldn't, because you never answered any of my messages."
I winced. Maybe coming back here hadn't been such a good idea after all.
"I'm sorry. I just..."
"Sorry!" Heidi yelled, slamming her hands on her desk.
"It's a little late for sorry!"
The raw anger in her voice was a shock. I'd known Heidi for years, but I'd never seen her get this emotional. To be honest, I hadn't realized she'd cared so much, which made me feel like a jerk. In my defense, I'd had a lot going on at the time, but that didn't take the sting out of seeing her stare at me like I'd stabbed her in the back.
"Why, Opal?"
she said, her voice cracking.
"I was your roommate. I thought I was your friend. Why did you leave without saying goodbye?"
"I wasn't doing it to be mean," I said, pulling off my goggles so that I could look at her properly. "And you are my friend. I needed a clean break, that's all."
"A clean break from what?"
Heidi demanded.
"Were you in trouble?"
I'd actually done it to get myself out of trouble, but I couldn't tell Heidi that. I'd lied to her enough back when we'd been roommates, which was one of the main reasons I'd left. I was tired of lying all the time. Tired of doing the dance that was necessary to keep everyone else safe. Tired of being me. Pretty gem of little value.
"I had to go," I said, hardening my voice. "I can't tell you more than that, but trust me when I say that it was for the best. I wouldn't have bothered you now. But I really need to know what this spell work... Please, bother me. Heidi begged, reaching out to grab my dirty hands. What part of I am your friend do you not understand? If you're in trouble, let me help. I'm still living in our old apartment. You can move back in any time you want. Or don't, I don't care. Just please let me help you. I can't stand to see you like this. You look homeless and you smell like death.
Told you,
Sybil whispered in my earpiece. I muted her with a flick of my finger and focused on Heidi. Thank you for the offer. It means a lot to me. It really does. But I can't. Heidi's brown eyes narrowed.
It's your dad, isn't it?
I stopped cold. No, I said after way too long.
You're not nearly as good a liar as you think you are, she said, crossing her arms. Look, I know you and your dad don't get along. Given the way you used to yell into your phone, I'm pretty sure the whole building knew. But if he's the reason you ran away, I swear I won't tell him you're back. Just come home. Whatever you're running from, we'll work it out together. I can even give you a job. There's an opening right now in my department. I can get you set up today if you want. For the love of God, Opal, you have a graduate degree from the best magical arts institute in the world. You don't have to dig through other people's trash to make a living.
I'd be lying if I said I wasn't tempted. After my last 5 months, moving back into Heidi's sun-drenched apartment on the Skyways sounded like paradise. But if she knew about my dad, then she was already in too deep. I'd left precisely so he couldn't use people like her against me. If I took her offer now, I'd be playing right into his hands. I can't.
Opal!
No, I said, clenching my hands into fists. I'm sorry about the way I left. I didn't mean to make you worry. I just had a lot of stuff I had to deal with on my own, and this was the only way I could do it.
By becoming a cleaner? She cried. How does that help anything?
It had helped a lot, actually. Unlike respectable art historians, no one cared what cleaners did. They came and went as they pleased, and they made their own money. Much better money than an entry-level job at IMA paid. Current bad luck notwithstanding. It wasn't neat or respectable, but I needed money more than I needed my pride right now. And anyway, I liked cleaning. It was surprisingly fun digging through people's lives, and sometimes I found great stuff. Heidi wouldn't understand that, though. From the look on her face, she clearly thought I was little better than a rag picker. And the fact that I looked the part certainly wasn't helping matters. I appreciate the job offer. Really, I do. But I'm not coming back. I held up my dirty poncho. It's not pretty, but this is my life now. And I'm happy with that. Honest. Heidi did not look convinced, but at least she didn't keep arguing.
So does that mean you'll answer when I message you now?
Sure. I lied. There was no way I could stay in contact with her. Not until my debt was paid and I was in the clear. But for all her talk about me being a bad liar, she must have bought it. Because for the first time since I'd come in, Heidi smiled at me.
How are you so stubborn?
She muttered, sinking into her office chair. Talent, I said, smiling back. So can you help me or not? She sighed.
What do you need?
I pulled out the folded notes I'd found in the warded box under the mage's bed. Can you look at these and tell me what they are? The forms look alchemical to me, but deciphering ancient spellwork is your area of expertise, not mine.
You always were more of a brute force-omancer, Heidi agreed,
wrinkling her nose as she plucked the papers from my hand. Do I want to know why they smell like dead animal? I shook my head, and she sighed, thumbing through the sheets as if she was grading papers. They're plans for a ritual, she said after a few minutes. I nodded excitedly. A ritual for what? Something big, she said, sounding interested now despite herself. The main structure involves multiple overlapping circles, which is an influence of modern thaumaturgy, but the core spellwork is absolutely alchemical. Primarily the Islamic forms, but there's lots of stuff stolen from the ancient Greeks as well. She glanced at me. Where did you find these again? In an amateur historian's apartment, I said, tactfully leaving out the bit where a said amateur historian had been lying dead right next to them. I'm trying to determine if they're valuable. They're certainly unique, Heidi said, laying the pages out on her desk in a grid so she could see all of them at once. Historically, alchemy was all about transformation, turning one thing into another. Usually lead into gold, but there's no mention of gold here. That was disappointing. Gold always sold. So what was he trying to do? I'm not sure, Heidi said, squinting at the papers. It looks as though he's using the transformational nature of alchemy as a tool to make something, but I can't see. Aha! She stabbed her finger down on a particularly doodle-covered page. Here it is. I had to find the central variable. This is a ritual to make a cockatrice egg. You can make those? I asked. Cockatrices were one of the many mythical animals that had reappeared when the magic came back. I didn't know much about them, but it seemed to me that cockatrice eggs would come from other cockatrices, not from alchemy. Cockatrice eggs were a vital ingredient in many Indo-European alchemy transformations, Heidi explained. You see them mentioned all the time in historical texts, but due to their organic nature, very few are still in existence, other than the ones laid by actual cockatrices, of course. But it takes an egg laid by a rooster and incubated by a toad to make a cockatrice naturally, which obviously doesn't happen very often, so most ancient alchemists just made their own. Unfortunately, the process for creating them was either so secret or so obvious, no one wrote it down. At least, we've never found a recipe. My heart began to beat faster. Does that mean these notes are valuable? Not to my department, Heidi said. I'm a magical historian, and while this little project is interesting, it's not historical. It also doesn't look very practical. I don't know how much a cockatrice egg costs these days, but this spell requires over $200,000 in reagents, some of which are extremely morally questionable. She shrugged. I'm sorry, Opal. It's an interesting piece of spellwork, but it's not valuable. It's not old enough or groundbreaking enough to be academically relevant. And I can't believe anyone would go through the trouble of gathering this many reagents just to make a cockatrice egg. My soaring hopes fell with every word she spoke. But I wasn't ready to give up yet. But do you think it would work? I pressed. If all the reagents were present and the spell was cast as written, do you think it would actually make an egg? Heidi shrugged. Probably. I mean, I don't see any reason it wouldn't work. But you can never tell with a spell until you actually cast it. Just speaking for myself, though, if I had those reagents sitting around, I'd sell them. Or turn them in to the proper authorities. Or even keep them for my own experiments. I certainly wouldn't waste them on this. Even if you love cockatrices, this spell is simply too expensive to be practical. I heaved a long sigh. Well, I guess that's that, I said, standing up. Thanks for looking, at least. Anytime, Heidi said, scraping the notes back into a neat stack and handing them to me. But do think about my offer.
I'm sure cleaning isn't actually as dangerous as the TV shows make it look, but you graduated with honors from IMA. You're better than this. Your skills are being wasted on this garbage. You are being wasted. And I hate seeing that. She gave me a plaintive look. Can I have your new number at least? Just in case I find a job that can tempt you away from cleaning?
I really didn't want to.
What was the point of sucking up the pain of cutting everyone out of your life if you were just going to let them back in?
But I couldn't take the way Heidi was staring at me, especially not after she'd helped me when I'd done nothing to deserve it. I could always change my number again later. So I wrote it down for her, lying through my teeth when she made me swear to answer her calls. By the time I finally left her office, I felt utterly defeated. Not only were the notes I'd pinned my hopes on apparently worthless, I'd been thoroughly reminded of my status as the world's worst friend. Definitely not my best day. And for all her claims of being a socially sensitive AI, Sybil wasn't helping.
I told you this was a waste of time,
she said as we climbed the stark white modern stairs back to the ground floor.
You should toss those stupid notes in the trash before they cost us any more.
Not yet, I said stubbornly. Some of those reagent receipts were dated less than a week before he went delinquent on his rent. I put up my hand to shield my eyes as we emerged from the basement into the late afternoon sunlight. That means he had to have bought them right before he died. You don't pay that much for a spell without trying it. I bet he'd either just cast it or was about to when he died. Either way, somewhere in this city, there's an unclaimed magical circle with a cockatrice egg or 200,000 in reagents inside it, and we're the only ones who know. That's worth keeping a line on, don't you think?
No, I do not, Sybil snapped. I think you're letting your optimism run away with you again. Even if you're right, and there is a pot of gold at the end of this wild goose chase, the DFC is 194 square miles that move around. The chance of you finding one mage's circle in all of that is practically zero. And we don't have the resources to waste trying. Need I remind you that if you don't have $10,000 by midnight on Friday, you're going to be screwed? You bought me to give you good advice. So listen for once. Forget this and let's get back to the cleaner office. If we hustle, we can still make it in time for the evening auction. There's always more stuff up for sale at night. We'll get a good unit, clean it fast, and turn a nice profit in time to go back tomorrow and do it all again. That's how we're going to make enough money to get through this. Not chasing wild cockatrices.
She was right, of course. Sybil was always right, which was why I downloaded her. But as sensible as her advice was, throwing away the notes felt too much like tossing a lotto ticket before the numbers were announced. I just couldn't bring myself to do it. So I tucked them back into my bag instead, ordering my AI to recall our truck before she could pull up a picture of eyes to roll at me. One of the hazards of living in a sentient city was that things were constantly moving around on you. It wasn't quite as bad as they made it seem in the movies, where characters went to sleep in one part of the city and woke up somewhere else entirely. But it wasn't uncommon for blocks to relocate themselves every couple of months. Being a municipal building, the cleaner's office moved more than most. The DFZ loved reshuffling buildings that were entirely hers, so it wasn't uncommon to have to drive to a different part of town every day just to go to the same place you always did. Thankfully, the office was still in the same place it had been this morning, taking up the lion's share of an underground block a mile west of the big casinos by the river. The building was actually an old elementary school, one of those indestructible brick monsters from the 1950s that had survived two magical apocalypses. I had no idea why the DFC had chosen something so old to be one of her personal buildings. She was relentlessly modern in everything else, demanding that all civic business be conducted online via smartphone, and rebuilding Town Hall every 6 months so that it was always on the cutting edge of architecture. Whatever the reason, though, I liked it. The old school had a gravitas that the rest of the eternally moving city did not. I also found the fact that it still had all of its original fixtures hilarious. You have not lived until you've watched a tricked-out chrome head with leg extenders trying to drink from a water fountain built for kindergartners. Of course, this also meant I had to put up with tiny toilets. But still, totally worth it. The auctions were held in the old school auditorium. There were two per day, one at 6 a.m. and one at 6 p.m. Which one I went to depended on my schedule, but I almost never attended both. Hitting two auctions in one day was for volume players and crazy people. But apparently I fit the latter today, because here I was, and I could already tell it was going to be bad. The room was packed. All the big cleaners were here, including DeSantos, which sucked, because I thought he was still on vacation. DeSantos was the current king of the cleaners. He had a 10-man team and a chain of second-hand stores to sell all the stuff they salvaged. He normally went for the big prizes, abandoned warehouses, closed shops, places with enough stuff to justify sending over a truck full of guys. This meant our interests didn't usually overlap, but that didn't matter. I didn't hate going up against DeSantos because he was competition. I hated being in auctions with him because DeSantos was a born troll who loved to bid people up. It didn't matter if he wanted a unit or not. If he thought you wanted it, he'd bid against you just for the pleasure of watching you squirm. Thankfully, he seemed distracted tonight, sitting in the front row and waving his hands through an AR interface I couldn't see, like he was conducting an invisible orchestra. I took the seat directly behind him, hoping that if he couldn't see me, he'd find someone else to pick on. I was arranging my goggles on top of my head so that Sybil's best camera was pointed at the stage when someone sat down in the folding chair next to mine. My head whipped around, and I froze, stomach curling into a knot. Great. Just great. The one night I really needed to win something decent, and Nicola Koss was sitting next to me. Other than DeSantos's bullying, Nick was my biggest roadblock at auctions. He was also a solo operator just like I was, which meant we tended to go for the same jobs. Small units we could clean for good profit in a reasonable amount of time. Unlike me, though, Nick didn't have 5 months of horrendous bad luck dragging him down, which meant if we ended up going head-to-head on an auction tonight, he was going to win. But while I resented his presence on a business level, what made me flinch away was simple self-preservation. After 3.5 years in the DFC, I was used to scary people. But Nick was a special kind of intimidating. It was hard to say why, exactly. He wasn't particularly tall or big, especially not compared to some of the other cleaners who'd gone so overboard on the cyberware and body ogs they couldn't sit in the folding chairs without crushing them. But while he didn't have any obvious modifications or weapons I could see, there was something about Nick that put me on edge. Maybe it was the way his gray eyes never stopped moving, sizing up each person as they sat down like he expected to be attacked at any moment. Or maybe it was the way he always sat on the edge of his seat with his hands in the pockets of his black leather bomber jacket, despite the fact that it had to be 90 degrees in here. Not that I could talk, of course. I was still wearing my warded poncho, and sweating like a sponge because of it. But I'd rather faint from dehydration than take off my protections anywhere close to Nick Koss. Other than winning units I wanted, he'd never actually done anything to me, but I'd lived among predators long enough to recognize danger when it sat down next to me. I was about to move to another seat, DeSantos be damned, when Nick's roving gray eyes landed on me.
"Look who's back for more,"
he said, glancing down to where my hands were clutching my bag, then to my goggles, then to my filthy boots before finally returning to my face.
"I heard you got sold a coffin."
"How'd you hear that?" I asked, because I hadn't told anyone except Broker and Peter. Nick shrugged.
"Did you get your money back? Or did Broker cut you a deal to preserve his no-refund streak?"
"Why do you want to know?" I asked suspiciously. He shrugged again.
Just trying to determine if you already picked the place over so I know not to bid on it when it comes back up for auction.
He flashed me a sharp smile.
So did you find anything good?
Now it was my turn to shrug.
You think I'd be back here if I did?
Yes,
he said without hesitation.
Cleaning a unit takes no time if you don't have to actually clean. You can grab the good stuff, auction it, have a nap, and come back for another round. That's what I'd do.
I sighed. That's what I would have liked to do. But there was no way I was telling Nick about my day of failure. So I changed the subject instead.
Why are you back? Didn't you win 2 jobs this morning?
I did, he said. But they were both evictions in closet communities. You know, the apartment buildings where all the units are 6x6 foot boxes stacked on top of each other. Those things take no time to clean. I had everything wrapped up before lunch. So now I'm back for more.
He said this as if it were a good day's work. But the more he talked, the more I pulled back into my chair. This was the real reason I didn't like Nick. Cleaning wasn't exactly a noble calling. We were scavengers who paid for the privilege of digging through other people's trash in the hopes of finding enough treasure to make it worth the effort. But at least I didn't kick people out of their homes for profit. A very good profit, admittedly. Unlike cleaning, you didn't have to bid on eviction jobs. The city paid a flat rate to clean out delinquent tenants, and you got to keep all their stuff in return for cleaning the apartment so it could be rented again. It was the best money you could make in this business, hands down. But desperate as I was for cash, there were some lines you just didn't cross. And apparently, terrifying broke people out of their tiny closet homes was mine. I was trying to think up an excuse to get away from this conversation when Broker walked into the room. I should point out that Broker was not Broker's real name. No one who made his money selling people's abandoned apartments to scavengers was stupid enough to give out anything that could be traced back to his real life. Even his face was anonymous, so perfected by plastic surgery that he looked more like a photo collage of menswear models than an actual person. He was the only full-time member of the collections or cleaning offices that any of us ever saw. And he made sure even that was a professional mask.
Settle down, children. Settle down, he said as he hopped up onto the stage. We've got a lot of units to get through tonight, so we're going to do this fast. First up are evictions. I've got 7. Who wants them?
I glanced hopefully at Nick. If he took another eviction job, that would remove my main competition. But my bad luck streak must have still been running hot, because his hand stayed down. There were plenty of other heartless thugs who loved cash in the room, though, and the evictions went quick, moving us on to the real show, the cleaner auction. Auctions were a pretty simple affair. Every unit up for bid had an address, square footage, and usually a picture taken from just outside the front door. Sometimes, if it was a really big place, you'd get a second picture from the back, for scale. But normally, those 3 bits were all the information you got. The trick to being a good cleaner was knowing how to use them. For example, tonight's first auction was for a 5-room penthouse in the financial district. The posh address was enough to get the new guys salivating, but I wasn't even tempted. Because while the picture showed a lot of fancy-looking furniture, the paintings above them were mass-produced reproductions of the same 10 super-famous modern works every wanna-look-rich jerk in the DFZ hung on his walls. They weren't even good reproductions. The printing on the copy of Foley's abstract masterpiece, New Spirits, hanging over the white leather sofa was so bad that I could see the artifacting from here. If the previous owner had been that sloppy about his art picks, the rest of his stuff was sure to be just as tacky and fake. I knew without even seeing them that the other 4 rooms would be packed with the same sort of cheaply made, overpriced junk. And while the downtown boutiques made bank selling that garbage to rich idiots who didn't know better, it was hell to move, and you couldn't resell it to save your life, which meant it was worthless. I wouldn't have paid $500 for that unit, much less the thousands the idiots in the back were shouting out. Nick and DeSantos kept their hands down as well. happy to let the competition waste their money. After that was when things got really interesting. Broker hadn't been kidding when he'd said it was a big list tonight. There was a whole slew of top-ticket items on the block, including an entire abandoned auto mechanic shop, complete with equipment. DeSantos was the only bidder in the room with enough people to handle something that size, and he ended up winning it for a song, the lucky bastard. He lost the next big offering, a boarded-up shoe shop, to Melly, an eccentric old lady who was always snapping bulk cloth and clothing lots to fuel her upcycled fashion business, but not before bidding her right to the edge of profitability. Thankfully, he seemed to calm down once we got to the mid-range auctions. Given how nice the list had been so far, my hopes were sky-high. But though there were a lot of units to choose from, I couldn't find one I wanted. Everything in my price range was too old, too risky, too boring, too damaged, too something. And when I did spot something promising, it quickly got bid out of my reach. Then, when we were getting close to the end and the auditorium was starting to empty out as winners left to claim their units, a picture flashed up on the screen that made me sit bolt upright. It was a townhouse in Magic Heights, one of the quiet little neighborhoods that moved around between the city's three major magical universities. I'd lived there myself during my first year at IMA, before I'd moved in with Heidi, and it was one of my favorite places to clean. It wasn't as rich as the big developments by the river where all the corporate mages lived, but what it lacked in money, Magic Heights made up in good taste and eccentricity. I'd scored some of my best finds there, so I would have been interested no matter what. But what really caught my attention now was the complicated spellwork painted on the front door frame. Spellwork I immediately recognized. It took every bit of self-control I had not to leap out of my seat. The burned-out ward in the picture in front of me had the same spellwork as the notes in my bag. The DFZ was a huge city full of mages, but the chances of there being two who used the same eccentric mishmash of modern thaumaturgy and ancient alchemy seemed impossible. It had to be the same guy. Opal? Sybil whispered warningly. Don't? I ignored her, lifting my finger to tap my wallet icon. My AR wasn't nearly as robust when I wore my goggles pushed up in my hair rather than properly seated on my face, but so long as the monocontacts inside the band were touching my body, I could still access the basics, including my bank account, which was what I checked now, wincing when the number flashed up. $2,016.32. That was not a lot of money, especially not for a unit in Magic Heights. But through the haze of my excitement, I could vaguely hear Broker explaining that this was a smashed unit, which meant it had been robbed. That caught me by surprise. I'd been so focused on the spellwork, I hadn't even noticed that the front door wasn't just open. It was missing entirely. The wood kicked until it had splintered into kindling. The rest of the place was similarly trashed. How trashed was impossible to say without seeing more, but every piece of furniture in the picture was broken. That made my heart beat faster than ever. We didn't get units until they'd been in collections for at least 30 days. Robbers were far less patient, so we saw smashed places a lot. They always went for peanuts, since presumably the thieves had already taken everything of value. But robbers didn't pay attention to spellwork unless it was in their way, like a ward. Other circles, especially ones full of custom, esoteric spellwork they couldn't read, might go unnoticed. Which meant the circle from the notes in my bag, or even better, the stuff used to power it, might still be there. Opal, my AI growled. Don't you dare! But my hand was already in the air. 200! Broker looked at me like I was nuts. The rest of the room did too, and I started to sweat. 200 was my usual opening bid, so I'd set it out of habit, which was a very stupid thing to do in hindsight. Bids on smashed units usually started in the tens. By bidding in the hundreds, I'd just tipped my entire hand. And from the way he was smirking at me over his shoulder like a hyena, DeSantos knew it.
300,
he called. I clenched my fists. 350.
What are you doing?
Sybil yelled in my ear.
The place is smashed. If anything was there, it's long gone. You don't have money to waste on this.
We have 350, Broker said. Do I hear 375?
Still grinning at me, DeSantos raised his hand. I glared back. 400.
500,
DeSantos said before I'd even finished. 6.
7.
1,000,
I snarled, hoping that would cut him off. DeSantos might love trolling, but there was no way messing with me was fun enough to risk wasting $1,000 on a robbed unit. Sure enough, the older man blew me a kiss and turned back around in his seat. It was just starting to hit me that I'd won when a new voice spoke from my left.
1,100, said Nick.
I whirled in my chair.
What?
Nick's sharp gray eyes met mine.
1,100, he repeated calmly. 1,100 from Mr. Koss,
Broker said, getting excited at the prospect of a real bidding war.
Do I hear 12?
Let him have it, Sybil whispered fiercely. I swear, Opal, I will cut you off from your bank account if you say one more.
I reached up and stabbed my finger through her mute button.
1,200.
13,
Nick said, leaning back in his chair.
14.
15.
2,000,
I yelled, breath coming fast. Even as I said it, I knew I was making a huge mistake. The chances of there being anything worth 2 grand in that apartment were slim to none. Even if they couldn't read the spell work, there was no way any self-respecting robber would miss 200,000 in casting reagents, or a cockatrice egg. This was stupid. I should have shut up and let Nick have the damn thing. At least that way I could have claimed I was just bleeding my competition. But I couldn't. From the moment I'd seen the spell work, I'd known. Known. There was something good inside. It was the same instinct that had led me to all the treasures I'd ever found. It had also lost me tens of thousands of dollars over the last few months. As always, though, I couldn't let it go. I was already bracing myself to go even higher when Nick shrugged in surrender.
2,000 going once, Broker said. Going twice.
There was a long pause. And then he clapped his hands together.
Sold to Miss Junge for $2,000.
The words echoed in my ears as I watched the money vanish from my account. Broker had already moved on to the next auction, but I didn't stick around to hear it. Whatever it was, I couldn't afford it. But done was done. So I hauled myself out of my seat and slipped past Nick toward the door to go see what I'd just spent all my money on.